Think about the last time you had to cancel a subscription. There's probably some waiting on hold, some guessing at your password, some mind-numbing small talk. And maybe, after all of that, you still weren't able to cancel it. Good news, it doesn't have to be this way, thanks to Rocket Money. Rocket Money tracks, manages, and can cancel your subscriptions for you. When you connect your accounts, you'll see a complete picture of all of your recurring subscriptions all in one place. Rocket Money organizes your subscriptions by due date and notifies you when something is coming up, so you'll never be caught off guard when you get charged. If you see a subscription you want to cancel, Rocket Money simplifies the process. Instead of waiting on hold for an hour, you can cancel it right from the app. Rocket Money will even try to get you a refund for the money you spent on subscriptions you forgot about. Stop wasting time trying to cancel subscriptions the hard way. Make your life easier and go to rocketmoney.com/cancel. That's rocketmoney.com/cancel, or download the app from the Apple App or Google Play Stores.
Marriott Bonvoy is the official hotel partner of US Soccer. Join Marriott Bonvoy today to get closer to the game with exclusive perks, unforgettable experiences, and benefits that go beyond the pitch. Spring Hill Suites, part of Marriott Bonvoy, offers complimentary hot breakfast and spacious all-suite accommodations, perfect for the whole team, with room for up to 6 guests. Make your next getaway a win. Learn more at springhillsuites.marriott.com.
Albert Glinsky has written the book Switched On, Bob Moog, I'm going to call it, and the Synthesizer Revolution. He bent the course of music forever, Rolling Stone declared. Here to tell us more, and my mispronunciation, is the man who wrote the book Switched On. This is Albert Glinsky. Albert, good morning to you in the States.
Hey, Giles, it's great to talk.
Come on, so I got the name wrong for a start. So how do you pronounce it properly?
Well, a lot of people probably recognize it as Moog, the Moog synthesizer, because that's the way it looks in English. But Bob himself changed it to Moog as his career was starting. And it's a funny story because it was Moog. That was a family name. And his wife was teaching in a one-room schoolhouse. And there were some farmer kids who said, Mrs. Moog, Mrs. Moog.
Ah.
And she just hated that. She came home and said, what can we do? And he said, well, we can use the original, you know, German-Dutch pronunciation. Moog. So from then on, it became the Moog synthesizer. So, you know, but people probably recognize it as Moog.
Well, we'll call it Moog from now on, because if it was good enough for him and stops the cat impersonations. If you look at the picture of Bob Moog, he does look like that sort of Einstein figure, doesn't he? Because if you think about where electronics was in the early 60s, and you think about the image it has now, everybody has the power to send rockets to the moon off their smartphones. But in those days, it was banks of wires and Giga was the size of a house. So it was a really kind of specialized science.
Definitely. I mean, Bob invented the synthesizer, which really kind of changed our whole landscape of sound. You know, the way we hear music now, the way we hear just, you know, sounds in general, by sort of hooking electronics to music and changing everything. And he kind of backed into it by accident in a sort of way. He always said he slipped backwards on a banana peel to invent this instrument, because it's like the guy who invented Velcro, you know, by going out taking a walk and some brambles are sticking to his socks, and next thing you know, we have Velcro. And Bob was playing around with circuits with a composer and just kind of came up with this thing, and it exploded. And the next thing you know, it was an industry, and it was kind of out of control, and it was almost hard for him to even do anything about it. So in the 60s, it really caught fire. It caught fire with the zeitgeist, because as they said then, you know, far out sounds were part of the 60s. And so it was present everywhere in the 60s. I mean, obviously the Beatles, the Doors, Kraftwerk, as you just pointed out and played. It went to the moon in the sense that it was celebrating the moon landing for people on CBS television. It was at Altamont. If people know about Altamont, that disastrous rock concert, Gimme Shelter, it was actually there. It was just all over the map. It was everywhere. And it was infecting people's minds, and it was part of the psychedelic movement too. And it's this one man who kind of backed into it, and he was kind of an Einstein figure, yeah, with his hair too, looked like that exactly.
But was he a musician? I mean, did he come from a keyboard background, or how did it actually happen? Because you said he sort of backed into it, so did he had a keyboard sort of, and through happy accident, he didn't electrocute himself, but he came out with this strange sound.
He did. Well, he was an engineer, and that was his background, but he always loved music. And when he was growing up, he got into combining electronics with music through the theremin. And I don't know if everybody knows what a theremin is.
Most spacey sound in the world, isn't it? Woo, that sort of thing,
exactly.
Isn't it?
Exactly. Well, I wrote a book all about the theremin and the inventor, and that's a whole other story. But the theremin, for anyone who knows what it is the only musical instrument you play without touching. You move your hands in two electromagnetic fields around these antennas, and it makes this woo-woo kind of sound. A lot of people know the sound kind of from Good Vibrations, you know, the Beach Boys, but it's in films, sci-fi films, all over the place. So Bob built this contraption, this theremin from hobbyist magazines. You know, it had been around for a while. That's how he got started. He took piano lessons as a kid. He hated it. His mother stood over his practicing and beat him on the knuckles when he hit a wrong note. So he hated taking piano, but he had that musical background. So then he started making theremins. He sold theremins in the early 60s. He got into the whole transistor thing when transistors came out, when the Japanese were making transistor radios and all of this. And then suddenly he just met this composer who said, I'm trying to make avant-garde music with all these kind of weird sounds, and I'm splicing tape with razor blades, and I'm doing all this stuff. It's so hard. Could you help me do it just purely electronically? So they got together, and Bob put some circuits together, and the next thing they knew, they had all these possibilities. You know, you could plug this patch cord in here or there or wherever you wanted, and this into that, and all these modules, and these sounds, these space-age sounds, just kind of came out. And I said, well, we have something here, but they still didn't know they were going to do anything with it. And then Bob took it to a convention, an engineering convention, and people started coming up, people who were writing for commercials, you know, radio commercials, television commercials, and they started coming up and saying, oh yeah, I like that, I'll take one of those and one of those. And he said, what do you mean you'll take it? Yeah, I want to buy this. And so that's how it all started. People said, I want to buy these things. The next thing you know, all sorts of people want it, the Beatles, the Doors, and he was in business, and he just He didn't know what to do, so he started making them.
I mean, how do you go from that sort of, you know, that, oh, happy mistake, we've got something here, taking it to an exhibition? I mean, how big was this? Because in the cover picture, he's surrounded by something like you could launch it up, you know, a Saturn V rocket off it from behind. It's all wires and whatever. So how big was Moog One then?
Well, the first one was actually not that big. It fit on a table, but it, like anything else with an idea, it kind of expands, gets bigger, bigger, bigger. And he added more modules, more things you could do. You know, there was filters and oscillators and amplifiers, and he just started adding more and more, and it grew to a really large size. So yes, eventually when Keith Emerson of Emerson, Lake and Palmer, who was one of the great users of the instrument, when he went on stage, they called it his Monster Moog, because this thing was ginormous. And that was part of the show, because people could see all the flashing lights and they could see all his, you know, plugging things in, because it looked like a nest of wires coming out of a cockpit of a you know, giant jet. That's kind of what it looked like on stage. So to have that was just a show in itself visually. And then the sound was unbelievable. So yeah, it was ginormous. It was really big until they started making it smaller. Like everything's been miniaturized, you know, with electronics now, but it got smaller and smaller. And the Mini Moog, of course, was, that's a whole other story.
Take it from that idea, you know, into production? Because this is the part of the story normally when the villainous businessman appears from behind the curtain and takes Bob's idea and leaves him sort of going in a puff of smoke, going, what happened there then?
Well, it was unbelievable. It's not like making T-shirts, you know. I mean, you don't just stamp out these things. There, they have hundreds of parts. It's really complicated to make these things, and he wasn't really prepared. And he found out that when he started making them, his customers, all of these very illustrious, you know, rock stars and people who wanted them up front, he could produce these. But by the time he got through paying for all the parts, hiring a staff, all of this, he wasn't really making any money. So he was nearly bankrupt most of his productive life. And he would like remortgage his house and remortgage it again and do all sorts of stuff to constantly feed this business because it was just impossible. He was the first one out in the field with making sense. And of course, everybody else jumped on it. And then he had competition, which made it even worse. So if financially, he was never that successful, but the instrument and the legacy of it is very successful. Today, Moog Music is a multi-million dollar business, but Bob didn't really live to see it grow into that, which is a shame. So people know these synthesizers today, but they may not realize that it started in this little shop in a little town in upstate New York, and it was just this place, a ragtag place, where people just threw these things together, but there wasn't a lot of money being made.
It's funny when you think about it, isn't it? Because if you think about one of my favorite sayings is nothing exists in a vacuum. Okay. So you have this new sort of transistor or this new electronics phase and everybody's getting, you know, model kits. And it was a thing. I remember everybody had these circuit breaker kits you played with as a kid. So we're showing our age, Albert, but there you go. And then we get very into that whole space age, you know, we're going to the moon, everything's space age and you've got Barbarella and you've got the films like that. But at the same time, you've got the hippie movement and people sort of cutting back and heading up to Woodstock and being all folky. And yet, this synthesizer, it covers all the bases. So you can be science fiction and forward looking because you've got a synthesizer. But at the same time, bands like, the Beatles couldn't have done a lot of their stuff, or the Stones couldn't have done a lot of their stuff and found their psychedelic soundscapes without synthesizers.
Yeah, that's actually a great point that you make, that they're like these two worlds. So you have this sort of scientific thing going on that's almost like on the level of, sending the astronauts to the moon. But on the other hand, the people who are on the receiving end of it are a lot of the heads and people who really just wanted to space out and listen to the music. And they were, part of the San Francisco scene, and they were giving out free food to people and this kind of thing, and living very modestly, and they were getting high all the time. So they weren't really part of that. So there was this, you're right, this is incredible kind of duality. There's a great story where when Bob went out for the first time to California, when his synth landed out there, he wasn't anything like part of the psychedelic world at all. He was a very straight-laced kind of a person because he grew up in the 50s. He always said, he didn't wear platform shoes, he didn't have bell bottoms, he didn't smoke dope, he didn't do any of this. He goes out to California and he's in the middle of a recording session for the album that really kind of put the Moog in many ways on the map. It was called Zodiac Cosmic Sounds, 1967. And they added this in, and he's hearing this thing, and he's seeing all of these recording engineers and people walking around, high-fiving each other and saying, this is the greatest head music in the world. Every head is going to have this music. And Bob, actually, I tell his story in the book. He says, I wasn't sure I wanted my synthesizer to be associated with this. And, it's crazy. When they originally invented the synthesizer, they didn't even know if they were going to put a keyboard on it because, it's electronic music. If you want to make the sound of rainfall or the sound of breaking glass, you don't need a black and white keyboard to play chords and melodies. You just need a button or something to set off the sound. And one of the people they consulted, keyboard, no keyboard, was Vladimir Yusachevsky, this composer from Columbia University, who was avant-garde classical composer, and he hated the idea of a keyboard. He said, hey, this was back in 1964, he said, don't put a keyboard on it. He said, if you put a keyboard on that, pop musicians are going to get hold of it and they're just going to make junk out of it. And of course, the rest is history,
Keep it away from those pesky pop musicians. But it did change the face. And suddenly everybody was getting into this, whether they, the Beatles, the Stones. I mean, it's much more because of the sounds it produces, because you know the theremin, you think, okay, that's somebody going woo in the background. But obviously the synthesizer completely changes the music. And at the same time, because there are massive advances in audio technology for live gigs, and also people are listening on their hi-fis at home, suddenly we've got high fidelity, we've got high, the radio is getting better. So suddenly because if you listen to the synthesizer, on a mono, yeah, so what? But if you listen to it in a gig with the huge Marshall stacks, or you listen to it on your new hi-fi at home, sitting back with in a beanbag with something rolled, and then you get this tremendous sound coming out of your new hi-fi, and that is the synthesizer.
Yeah, absolutely. It was totally new, and it really did change the face of everything. One great example, director Francis Ford Coppola wrote the foreword to my book, and why that is particularly important is that Apocalypse Now, one of his very iconic films, the score was written by his father, Carmine Coppola, and it was totally new process at that time. They wanted a completely new kind of sound atmosphere to describe this Southeast Asia kind of drug trip battle, all this crazy stuff going on. So Carmine Coppola wrote this regular film track score with orchestra, but then they took it and synthesized all the parts. So when you hear this, even subliminally, people may not realize this, when you hear the wop-wop of the helicopter, the famous helicopter moment in the beginning of Apocalypse Now, when a helicopter kind of goes across the screen a couple times, different ways, that's synthesized. And so what Francis Coppola wanted was, he said, okay, let's take the sound of locusts in the jungle and make that a synthesizer. Let's take the sound of gunfire and make that a synthesizer. And yet it's all blended into the music. And so that became a really amazing subliminal kind of thing for people for the first time in a film to kind of say, what is this? It's kind of halfway acoustic instruments and halfway electronic. And that was another way of changing a whole sound landscape we have today.
But the thing with that is that's 1979. So we've now moved on from the earlys, and directors are starting to see the possibilities. So rather than go, here's a novelty item, with the best possible taste, obviously, but here's something that is new, which is listen to the Moog, and you can tell it's, or the Moog, you can tell it's the sound of a synthesizer. Now you're getting to the stage where film, because if you say Apocalypse Now, everybody thinks The Doors, everybody thinks, da 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 da. They don't, but it's the soundscape that sets the tone of the movie in a subtle way. And so if you can't work out that that's not synthesized locusts and he didn't have a little bag that he was shaking, and knowing what happened on that film, it's entirely possible with Brando, or he didn't have a helicopter coming over at 30 feet whilst recording, then if you don't notice that it is a synthesizer, then it's done its job as part of the soundscape.
Well, that's true. It just sort of blends in. But then you have people like Donna Summer, of course, and that's iconic. And of course, that's 77. That's 2 years before. And then, that's the whole disco movement that kind of opened up, EDM and electronic dance music and everything, and Giorgio Moroder used a Moog for everything in that, except Donna Summer's voice and one drum, which is there. But he even used that hissing sound of a cymbal and all of that. So it's all done with, white noise on the synthesizer. And so that was a transformational moment for people in discos who heard this new sound, because up until then it was like, orchestras and acoustic instruments recorded for disco, and all of a sudden this new sound comes in. And so today we take EDM for granted, we take all of, techno and all of these types of things for granted. But, where does it go back to? It goes back to that seismic change in the sound of dance music that is electrified.
Please tell me somewhere, Albert, there's a picture of Bob in Studio 54 with Giorgio Moroder and Donna Summer cutting it, because he would have liked the dance style surely of that rather than these hippies, and he would have loved Kraftwerk.
Well, right. Are you talking about Bob himself?
Bob. I mean, I can just see Bob himself in a sharp suit in Studio 54 with Giorgio and Donna, cutting a rug, as we say.
Well, yeah, I kind of hate to burst the bubble of that idea, but Bob wasn't that kind of person at all. He really wasn't. I mean, he went along with it. He got a kick out of it, but he really didn't smoke dope. He didn't do any of that sort of thing. He sort of stood on the sidelines and watched and was amused, but it wasn't really something. There is a club, or at least there was a club in Barcelona, I believe, the Moog Club. I'm not sure it's still there, but I talk about it in my book. And Bob did a tour the year before he died. He did this big world tour. And one of the places he stopped off in was the Moog Club in Barcelona. And people there were thrilled to see the man himself at that club. Whether he danced there, I don't know. Maybe he did, but it sort of, at that point, he was like, 70 years old. So I don't know whether he would have been dancing in the club. But I mean, that would be a real kind of fantasy to think of Bob doing something like that.
And then showing the influence it has, because in the mid-70s, we get Kraftwerk, and everybody goes on, and, you know, we have, at the same time, we have prog rock, which has, you know, massive amounts of synthesizers and dragons and wizards and people doing things.
Right.
And these huge productions. But then you've got guys in their bedrooms with synthesizers. You don't need a drummer. You don't need a guitarist. You just need a couple of these, and you have about, and we have that late 70s, as well as punk and post-punk going on and Blondie and New Wave. You've got these guys coming out like Depeche Mode, you know, coming out of the States. Obviously, Kraftwerk have been doing it since the mid-70s. And it totally, you know, regenerates, goes back to those, you know, guys playing or girls playing in their bedroom with a keyboard making music.
Exactly. And, you know, it's interesting because there are two issues there that tie in with that. The American Federation of Musicians, the union, the musicians union, was really, they went crazy because they thought now, you know, you don't need musicians, so musicians are going to lose work. And of course, musicians have lost work. You know, you go into a Broadway pit today, you know, you will still see synthesizers there, and musicians lost a lot of work because of the synthesizers. So that was one thing. The other thing is that Bob himself, and I talk about this in the book too, he had regrets late in life because he said that he thought that his synthesizer actually took away from the social aspect of music making, where people get together with their instruments and they play. And he said he really felt bad about that because, yes, the whole idea of a digital audio workstation, you know, today, where you can sit at your computer and you can create anything you want. You know, if you have a microphone, you can sing into it and create a track, but everything else can be done, as you say, in your bedroom, that kind of thing. You know, even Stevie Wonder, in his Secret Life of Plants album, at one point had his synthesizers, you know, in his home, and he was able to do that all on his own pretty much. So it really did, it was great on the one hand. Yes, anyone with a bedroom and some equipment can make an album. It's great. But on the other hand, Bob felt that whole social aspect of bringing people together to make music was being killed in some ways by what he had started, you know?
Yeah, but I suppose you could argue that he gives them the tools for creativity with the synthesizer, and what they do with it next is up to them. So they can take it. They can say, okay, I've got this outline for a song. These are the parts. I've already got them in my head or got them on synthesizer, and then take them to a live band. Or you can sit in, I was going to say you can put it in YouTube, but we didn't have that back in the 70s. So you know, I give you the tool. Do with it what you will. What was he? Yeah.
Yeah, well, no, I was going to say there is live performance very much, which people today do. One of my favorite bands of all time is Churches, you know, the Scottish band. And Ian Cook, one of the three members of Churches, well, three or four, if you count the drummer now, he uses a Moog Voyager. And you can see M-O-O-G very prominently on the back of his instrument at their live shows. And of course, you know, they travel all over the world and perform. So yeah, live performance, and since, of course, it was very, very big too. So I mean, that's the social aspect of music too, and you're bringing together these huge crowds, of course, too.
Exactly. When you interview people who have broken the mold and come up with something revolutionary, sometimes they can be eccentric characters to interview. They can be prickly, for example. They could be not what I mean. How was Bob?
Oh, Bob himself was fantastic. I mean, interviewing him was great. I mean, he was just, that's the thing about Bob. You know, you see these images of him that the company would advertise. There's one famous one on a front of a brochure from 1976 where his white hair, his puff of white Einstein-y hair is made to look almost like a mushroom cloud or something, or, you know, it's over his head. And then there are all of these psychedelic images in his hair, and they painted him as this kind of psychedelic guru. But when you knew Bob and you met him, he was really like the man next door that you want to, you know, borrow a lawnmower from or something, you know. I said, you know, he was just a natural kind of guy. He wasn't pretentious. He never made you feel unimportant or anything. Somebody said Bob always made you feel, when you were in his presence, like you were his best friend, you know. And that's such a great trait. So Bob himself was not eccentric to interview, but I interviewed, you know, over 65 people in the whole legacy for this book. And there were, yes, there were some eccentric people, definitely, you know, and sometimes people would, you know, memories are very bad. Sometimes anyone has ever interviewed someone about historical things, you know, sometimes they place themselves in parts of the story where they actually weren't, you know, because you can find letters and documents and you go, wait a second, that doesn't add up. That person wasn't, you know, wasn't living in that part of the world at that time when they claimed that they, you know, that kind of thing. So sometimes you have to cut through all of that. So that's part of the eccentricity. And then there are just some really interesting characters who I paint in the book, you know, really, really off the beat characters.
But if, I mean, if, on that thing, if you had all the people that said they saw Jimmy play at Woodstock, and then you see the picture of Jimmy at Woodstock, and there's about, I don't know, a couple of hundred, but there are like 500,000 people who said, "Oh, I saw, I was there and saw that last day performance." So they paint themselves in, and it's important as well not to, because we've touched on the film, but I mean, film scores have been changed through to the stuff that the Zimmer's doing now. You know, the brilliant stuff of Interstellar, which also features a Zerafim as well in Interstellar, but all those film scores would not be possible, bringing back the motifs, without the use of this machinery.
Oh, yeah, definitely. Because in the beginning, it was the kind of thing. Nowadays, we have, of course, virtual synths, you know, soft synths. You can do all sorts of stuff. In the early days, though, it took a lot to get those kind of sounds that Hans Zimmer and people like that now can do electronically. It was just crazy. I tell another story in my book about The Doors when they were recording Strange Days. And Paul Beaver was this guy. He was one of the few people who in California who could operate a Moog at the time. And they brought him into the studio and they said, "We want some sounds for this album." So, you know, he was sitting there plugging the patch cords, you know, into the modules, and he was trying out sounds. And they said, "Oh, that's really great. Oh, we love that. Oh, that's nice." And then they, at one point they said, I think it was Jim Morrison said, "You know, can you go back like three sounds back of that sound of glass breaking into the void, you know?" And Paul Beaver turns around and says, What sound is that? I don't know." And he couldn't go back. They realized there was no way to go back to that sound because it was so complex with all of these combinations of wires. You had to take what you got at that moment. It was almost trial and error. You couldn't go back to your previous sound. So, you know, it was very experimental in the early days. No, nothing digital, nothing that you could, you know, go back to.
It just, but with Jim Morrison in the building, the sound of the breaking glass, I should imagine, after about the third chord of whatever could be reproduced fairly easily. What do you hope? What do you hope that people are gonna take and learn from? Because we know the machine, but we don't know the man, do we really?
No, I don't think people do that much. And that was one of the driving forces behind my book, was it's not just a book about the instruments and about the musicians who used it and about the legacy of the synthesizer, but it's also about the man himself. And so I think people will learn a lot about the man himself. He was a person who had a lot of contradictions, his religious life. He went from, Judaism to some Native American ideas to being almost an atheist and back to Judaism, and all throughout his life, crazy things happened to him. He had two marriages. The first marriage, the mother of his four kids, was very difficult. It was a very difficult marriage for many years. It was crazy. And he was always losing his shirt financially. People don't realize this. You know, you think Moog is like IBM, AT&T, you know, you think, "Oh yeah, you know, this is a multi-million dollar corporation." I mean, today it is, but when Bob was running it, it wasn't. And nobody realizes that. So in my book, I tell this story about this seat of the pants man who's just hanging on and literally throwing, you know, his own personal money again and again, you know, into this company to keep it afloat, while all these musicians are just having so much fun with it and don't think anything of it. Everybody wanted a free Moog because they figured, "Oh, well, you know, Keith Emerson said, you know, give me a free instrument because I'm going to take it on tour all over the world. I'll give you publicity." And Bob couldn't do that. He wasn't in that position. So Keith Emerson had to buy a Moog. He actually bought a used one, but he bought a Moog, you know, because they had to pay for it. And I ran into that myself, because when I wrote my first book about the theremin and Leon Theremin, I wanted to go on a book tour. And I called up Bob and I said, well, you have these wonderful theremins. Could you maybe give me one and I'll take it on tour and I'll talk all about your theremins? And he said, there was a long pause because Bob, sometimes you thought you were disconnected on the phone because he was thinking about what his answer was. And there was this long pause and he said, that'll be $369. Oh. And, I thought, oh, well, wait a second. Okay. And I thought, that's all right. So years later, I was going through his papers and I realized, of course, they were counting every penny at that point in the business. He couldn't even afford to give me a $369 machine, and he had, told Keith Emerson, we can't afford it. So that's another thing people will learn about Bob. And he was not one of these people who wanted to particularly make a lot of money. That may sound crazy in our modern world. He didn't want to be Mark Zuckerberg. He didn't want this sort of Silicon Valley model of, having venture capitalists, make your company, all of this. He basically had sort of a much more of a kind of what we call today like a lifestyle business, where he just wanted to be able to break even. He wanted to be able to support his family, and he wanted to make synthesizers because that was his love. His brain was always, going into all these side projects and things because he was at heart an inventor, but he wasn't a businessman. So that's another thing people will learn.
And in a world which is saturated by sort of tech ego-driven tech wizards and who are taking over the world and having a bash at space, there's nothing wrong in having something that just supports your lifestyle just to be puddling around quite nicely.
Yeah, oh, definitely. And he did sort of manage to support his family, but there were some very tense times. And at one point, he sold his company to somebody else, and then he became the employee. And they didn't really treat him very well, I have to say. There's some shocking stories in there. Here's this man who, bent the course of music forever, according to Rolling Stone. And the same year that, they said that, he was subjected to this kind of merit report, like employees sometimes where, somebody comes in and checks off, exceeds expectations, falls below expectations. And he got some, some low marks because at his own company, where he was now an employee, he wasn't making golden eggs. He wasn't laying golden eggs. He wasn't constantly coming up with new stuff because for them now it was the bottom line. And he didn't think that way at all. He just wanted to make wonderful instruments. So, he was really, that was not a good time for him.
The book, we're going to run out of time, but I don't believe it or not. The book is called Switched On, Bob Moog and the Synthesizer Revolution. It's by Albert Glinsky, who we've been speaking to today. Albert, if people want to find you online, do you do the social media thing? Can they find you online?
Well, the fastest way to find me online would be my website, which is just albertglinsky.com. And then from there to other things. But that would be right now the fastest way.
And there's an audio book coming out as well, you told me.
Yes, the print book and the ebook are published by Oxford University Press in the U.S. And actually, November 24 is going to be the European release date of the book. It was just released in America on the 23rd of September, and then the audiobook is scheduled to come out in February on Tantra Media, which is Recorded Books Incorporated. So I'm very excited about that too.
We look forward to that. The book is called Switched On: Bob Moog and the Synthesizer Revolution. It's by Albert Glinsky. Albert, it's been an absolute pleasure and a scream to speak to you today.
Well, thank you. Likewise, I really appreciate it. And it's been great.
Marriott Bonvoy is the official hotel partner of US soccer. Join Marriott Bonvoy today to get closer to the game with exclusive perks, unforgettable experiences, and benefits that go beyond the pitch. Spring Hill Suites, part of Marriott Bonvoy, offers complimentary hot breakfast and spacious all-suite accommodations, perfect for the whole team, with room for up to 6 guests. Make your next getaway a win. Learn more at springhillsuites.marriott.com.